sound and feel, so I put both to good use. I don't understand the purpose of the tethering chain connected to the handcuffs around my wrists. Best I can tell, I have full range of the room, so it's hardly limiting access. Is it to keep me from bounding through a suddenly opened door, racing toward the light? I don't know. Then force myself to put it from my mind. Motives aren't worth worrying about yet. Tangibles are. I explore the room. 9 steps form the width, side to side. 12 long strides provide the length. Contents appear to be 3 items. A twin-size mattress, flat on the floor, covered in a simple cotton blanket, a standard-issue plastic bucket, sans handle, and a coffin-size box. I still hear breathing, slow and even, in and out, in and out. It becomes the background noise for my endeavors, like the sound of ocean waves, the rhythm of my heartbeat. I already hate it. Windows, 3 of them. With my fingertips, I can make out the trim. 2 upon one wall, both modest in size. Singles, I believe you'd call them. Classic New England architecture. The larger window is on the wall across from them. Twice as wide as it is tall, its dimensions remind me more of a mirror. When I run my fingers along it, I feel cool glass. In contrast, the smaller windows across from it are textured and rough, as if painted or otherwise obscured. I try to scratch at the coating with my fingernails, but can't make a dent. So, not residential paint, but maybe something more industrial, such as powder coating or enamel. These windows must be outer windows, thickly covered, hence my lack of light. As for the larger, unpainted glass surface across from them, I'm guessing that's an internal wall. Which doesn't make sense for such a large picture window. Unless, of course, it's not a window at all. A one-way mirror? That's what I'm thinking. I can't be certain, of course, but why construct such an elaborate setting for his playthings if not to watch the festivities inside? I'm sure it's only a matter of time before the lights come on. Blinding, disorienting. And the unsub? Ask Samuel. That's unidentified subject in FBI speak. We'll take advantage of the chaos to check in on his charges. Or maybe he's watching even now. Military-issued night vision goggles? Anything is possible. You must understand. Whatever demented thing you're too scared to consider, that's exactly what they're already fantasizing about. The big bads out there? Denial won't help you. Suppression won't save you. Best to meet it head-on. Understand the enemy. Accept their depravities. Then find the void and soldier on. Breathing. Still so relentlessly even. In, out, in, out. How can she remain asleep? How can she not hear me bumbling around in the dark, tripping over the mattress, stubbing my toe against a wall here, the box there? I can't think about the coffin-sized box. I can't consider its possibilities, its contents. If I do, I lose the void. Because I'm good alone. I understand alone. I intended always, forever, to be alone. So the box, the fucking Darth Vader wannabe, not part of the equation. A totally unwelcome addition to my plan. Is she drugged? That's the only thing that makes sense to me. How else to explain unconsciousness lasting this long? Of course, I'm not sure how long this long has been. I fell asleep early afternoon. I woke up to an intruder in my apartment after dusk. And now? I hate the damn dark. It's disorienting. I center my thoughts. I comb the room, using sight and sound, which can be more helpful than you think. Above the larger window, the viewing window, I identify a high wall-mounted object. Smaller, soft, and foamy to the touch, it's situated to the left of the smooth glass mirror. A speaker, I'm guessing. He watches, and then eventually he'll talk. Orders, taunts, whatever. But sooner or later he'll make himself known. And when he does, it'll be all about him asserting control. Breathing. In, out, in, out. I should use it. Roll it into the void. Turn it into part of my separation. Like focusing on the wind in the trees, or utilizing the toll of a bell. I can't fight it. I can't change it. I can't block it. Hence, use it. Make it one with me. I hate the damn breathing. I find myself standing over the box, tracing its shape, noting the roughness of the edges. A crude job. I'd like to say I recognize the craftsmanship. But cheap pine boxes are a dime a dozen. I never learned if Jacob crafted his own or purchased it elsewhere. I never asked the question before, and I certainly can't ask it now. She's dying. I know that, kneeling over the box, because that's what happens to girls trapped in coffin-sized boxes. Physically, mentally, is there a difference? This girl, whatever made her her, is ebbing away, leaking into the wood, the floor, the black-painted room, bit by bit, inch by inch. Soon, evil kidnapper will pop open this lid and she'll do whatever, say whatever he wants, because it won't matter anymore. The person she was will be gone, only the shell will remain. Girl bot, ready for programming. The type of automaton ready to give up her own beloved father's name. I hate this girl in the box, as I discover myself slowly but surely shredding my own fingernails, a habit hard broken 4 years ago. I fist my hands, feel the pressure of my nails digging into my palm, and will myself into the void once again, while she continues to breathe in, out, in, out. Padlock, standard issue, that's what secures the lid. I have a moment tracing the metal latch where once again I'm in a filthy, food-stained, sex-soaked basement, studying my own box from the outside in. The sense of déjà vu unsettles me, makes this whole thing feel way too personal. More like evil kidnapper went looking for me than I went looking for him. Back into the void, back into the void, back into the void. Feel nothing. Analyze everything. Her breathing. In. Out. In. Out. Stacy Summers? Could it be possible? Have I found her at last? Suddenly the void is gone. I feel only panic instead. I hate her, this girl, Stacy Summers, whoever. I don't care. She shouldn't be here. I left behind this fucking box. I dealt with the devil. I bargained my soul. I did what, according to Samuel, survivors do in order to see another day. So how dare some girl get herself trapped in a box again? How dare she ruin this for me? In. Out, in, out, breathing, breathing, breathing. And just like that, moving before I even know I'm going to move, I fist my bound hands together and smash them against the top of the box. Again, and again, and again. Wake up, wake up, wake up! Wake the fuck up! Breathing, in, out, what the hell? Who can sleep through this? It must be drugs, the only answer. I bang again, I can't help myself. I'm furious. At her? At me? At him? I don't know anymore. The box, I think. I'm furious at the fucking box. It must go. I need it to be gone. I find myself shaking the whole thing. It's cheap enough, wobbly enough to move beneath my angry ministrations while she breathes. In, out, in, out. I pound the box. Its corresponding shudder gives me another idea. Under different circumstances, I would pick the lock, but having been abducted from the comfort of my own bed, I lack the tools I would normally have on me. Two very tiny, innocuous-looking black plastic clips that are actually universal lock picks. But maybe I don't need them. The box shudders and shakes every time I hit it. It's definitely cheap construction. I batter against it with fresh determination. I shove it side to side, feeling the top loosen, the joints give, until with a horrific scream, I toss it onto its side, roll it all the way over, a full 360. When it rights itself again, rocking beneath my fingertips, I can feel the lid is ajar. Breathing. In. Out. In. Out. How can that even be possible? I grab the lid, wrench it further until it dangles from its metal latch. Take that, Mr. Amateur Hour. Breathing. In, out, in, out. I can't see. The darkness encroaches. The darkness obliterates. So I reach my hands in, fully prepared to grab the occupant from its depths and yank her to salvation. Except nothing. No body, no warmth, no solid mass. I find emptiness, 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 and yet I can still hear it. Breathing, in, out, forever steady, the rhythm of my heartbeat. I search the entire coffin-sized box, with my wrists bound together, my fingers fluttering like butterfly wings, empty, 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 until finally at the base, a tiny recorder, taped to the bottom of the casket, apparently playing over and over again, breathing, in, out. And in that instant, I'm sure the breathing is mine. Pre-recorded while I was unconscious, just as the box is mine. There is no second victim. There is only me. Always me. I look up at the glass window I can't see it in the dark, but I can feel it before me. I know he's there, watching, waiting, enjoying the show. So I smile. I lift my wrists. I offer him one middle finger. Then I rise from the demolished coffin. I head to the single mattress. And though my heart is thumping wildly and my pulse racing uncontrollably, though I understand now that this isn't a matter of simple kidnapping, that this man seems to know things he shouldn't know, that I am even less in control than I thought, not just another victim, but perhaps the intended victim, I force myself to lie down and turn my back to him. Find the void. Live in the void. In the void, no one can hurt you, and if no one can hurt you, then you never have to be afraid again. If I could go back in time, if I could do one thing, I would drive to my mother's farm. I would sit across from her. I would eat her homemade muffins, accept her sun-brewed tea, and I would let her love me. Except having spent so much time in an empty void, I no longer know how to feel again. Chapter 19. Once the decision was made to take me with him on his trucking route, Everett swung into full preparation mode. He adopted my father's name while I would be called Molly. He drilled me, my name, his name, made me sign another postcard for my mom. I wrote what he said, signed what he wanted. I thought my handwriting looked foreign and strange. Maybe this is what handwriting looked like for girls named Molly. When I was done, fake Everett handed over stiff blue jeans and an oversized white T-shirt, declaring Florida the Sunshine State. He'd included underwear and a bra as well, but the bra was several sizes too large and looked like something only a grandmother would wear. When I held it up questioningly, he just shrugged and knocked it to the floor. He ordered me to shower, on account of the close quarters, he informed me. I noticed he had also recently bathed, hair actually combed, and was wearing one of his less stained T-shirts. He watched me in the bathroom as I quickly soaked up my dirt-encrusted skin, scrubbed my long, matted hair. He continued staring as I awkwardly sorted through the cheap, oversized clothes, doing my best to pull them up over my still damp skin. My hands shook. I kept my gaze on the dirt-brown carpet, certain at any moment he'd snatch the clothes away, toss me down, and... But he didn't. If anything, he seemed irritated by my clumsiness. When I finally dragged the T-shirt over my dripping wet hair, he produced a comb from his back pocket and ruthlessly dragged it through my hair himself. Next up from his back pocket, scissors. I flinched. In response, he chuckled. "Hair's a fucking mess," he said, his way of making conversation. I wanted to tell him of course it was a fucking mess. No hair, and certainly not my fine blonde hair, was meant to be shampooed with a cracked bar of ancient hand soap. My locks were accustomed to a soothing regimen of tea tree oil-based shampoos and citrus-scented conditioners. Then there was the weekly deep-conditioning hair mask to add volume, and the monthly highlights for shine. Once upon a time I'd been a teenage girl, with standards, and gorgeous, glossy, California-inspired long blonde hair. Now? I kept my gaze lowered, feeling the stiffness of my new denim jeans as he fisted the first clump of hair, then went to town. Three snips, that's all it took. Three giant handfuls, three decisive cuts. The wet strands rained down onto the carpet.
"Crap," he said. "I think I made it worse." "Oh well, that's what hats are for."
I didn't say a word. Just like that, I'd become Molly, and we both knew it. But we weren't done yet. He forced me to turn around, covering my eyes with a black strip of cloth, smelled like a musty old T-shirt, then tied it behind my head, obscuring my vision. I never got to watch myself leave the basement prison. Best I could do was track the tops of my bare feet as he pulled me across the dirty carpet to the far door, a creak as it opened, and then, much as I'd suspected, stairs leading up. He pushed me ahead of him. I stumbled once, twice, three times. He whacked me in the back of the head hard enough to make me wince, and I found my balance. At the top, a brief pause as he reached around me to open another door, then a change in flooring from cheap commercial-grade carpet to peeling gray linoleum. Was this his house? I wondered as he yanked me forward into what I assumed must be a kitchen. It smelled like the rest of him. Disgusting. I tripped over my own feet again, trying to slow things down or honestly uncoordinated. I didn't know anymore. I'd agreed to my new identity. I'd given up my father's name rather than be left alone down in that horrible place, and yet, funny how you can fear change, even when already surrounded by the worst of the worst. Fresh air. Suddenly I could feel it. Stumbling through the kitchen, out another door, we'd exited the house, to the outside. Front yard? Backyard? Who knew? Who cared? I was standing outside with the wind on my face, and for a second I couldn't help myself. I dug in my bare heels. I lifted up my face. Outside, fresh air, the rustle of trees. After so, so long. How long? So, so long. Fake Everett paused. He gave me one moment. I used it to peer straight up over the top of my blindfold, and then I could see them. Trees soaring high above me, thick and dark against a dimly lit sky, woods, forest, freedom. Maybe I really was only miles from my mother's farm.
Georgia, Everett said, as if reading my mind. Found this place years ago. My own little mountain hideaway. Course, old geezer who owned it died, and now his no-good kids want it back, so we're out of here. Life on the road. That's more fun, anyway.
Trees, I was still thinking. Forest, woods, just like my mother's farm. And then I couldn't see anymore because there were too many tears blinding my eyes. With the blindfold on, I couldn't see my way around the house to his big rig. He had to help me step awkwardly onto the wide running board, then grab my arm as I tripped over the driver's seat. I'd never been in a semi before, knew nothing about them. Long-haul trucks were merely vehicles I'd seen on the highway, carrying goods this way and that. Definitely I'd spent more time and attention on my hair. Now, Fake Everett chattered proudly about his raised-roof sleeper cab, his home away from home. Came complete with a top bunk, coffee maker, and, of course, a portable DVD player for entertainment. He dragged me around to the driver's captain chair as he was talking. I could feel carpet beneath my bare feet, thicker and nicer than what had been in the basement. It smelled better in here, too, still tainted by the lingering odor of greasy food, but with an overlay of pine-fresh scent, as if at least the truck had been cleaned recently. It deserved that much effort. When I first heard the screech of a latch opening up, I didn't understand it. Then Fake Everett gave me a push, and I pitched forward, as if falling off a step or two. Before I could recover, his hand was squeezing my shoulder, forcefully pressing me down. Too late, I realized I was now standing on a hard wooden surface, the smell of pine. And just like that, I was back in a coffin-sized box, fully clothed this time, with a blindfold over my eyes.
"What's your name?" he demanded from above.
"Molly," I whispered, too disheartened, too defeated for anything more.
"Mine?"
"Everett."
"Who am I?"
"Whoever you want to be."
"I'm your uncle. Uncle Everett. Where are you from?"
"Florida," I guessed.
"With that accent? Hardly. We'll say your mama raised you up north, but now you're staying with me."
I didn't say anything. He'd get his way. He always got his way. What did I care? Maybe I really was Molly now, because surely the girl I'd been.
"Loading up, dropping off, you're in the box," he stated.
I didn't respond, feeling more confused than rebellious. Locked in a box with a blindfold on? What did it matter? He tugged sharply on a ragged lock of my hair. I nodded belatedly, if only to show I was paying attention.
"Rest stop, sleepovers, you're in the box."
I nodded again.
"Other times..."
His voice drifted. He seemed to hesitate.
"Be good, play your cards right, and maybe you can come out for a bit. Keep me company."
I frowned, not understanding. Was he saying I might join him in the cab? As in, sit in the passenger seat? As in, like a real person?
"You'll sit on the floor," he clarified now. "No one can see you. Maybe, maybe not, I'll take the blindfold off. But you'll be out of the box. Assuming you're good, of course. Do exactly as I say.
He paused, waiting expectantly. And finally I got it. I was leaving the basement, really, truly leaving, and for my punishment, reward, I would now spend all my time, 24/7, with this man. This mean, filthy, awful man in his castle of a big rig, where he got to rule the highway, personal sex slave, chained to his side. And in that instant I understood something else as well. That he was doing this versus killing me. Which he'd promised to do so many times before, right before explaining how he'd then roll my body into the nearest canal and let the gators ensure my mother never saw me again. Everett wasn't going to kill me. He was going to keep me instead. I wondered in the back of my mind if that meant he'd grown to like me somehow, and I wondered in the back of my mind if that meant I was supposed to like him, too. Everett planted the palm of his hand over my face and forced my head down into the box. I assumed the position, mind churning as the lid came down. The padlock jangled. My moment of freedom ended. I became once again a girl in a coffin-sized box. Except now... now I was a girl in motion. He liked to talk while he drove the big rig. Complain, really, about the price of gas, the asshole in the Honda Civic who just flipped him off, the pricks at the understaffed loading dock who'd just cost him 2 damn hours, and now he couldn't even take a break for lunch. In the good old days, he'd grouse, the smart trucker could fudge his driver's log and carry on, but no, everything's now federally mandated electronic this and federally mandated electronic that. Big brother, always watching. Welcome to the life of a long-haul trucker, he'd tell me, working for assholes while driving through an entire country of assholes. In the beginning, every time the rig's engine fired to life, I flinched. Every time the truck bounced down a rutted road, I went bug-eyed with nausea. After so much time alone in the basement, this, the smell of diesel, the roar of pistons, the violent hum of the beast, was almost too much to take. And yet, much like my experience with the overwhelming boredom of the basement, I learned to adapt. I relaxed my shoulders into the jerk and sway. I absorbed the relentless growl and hum. And bit by bit, I started to discern the nuances of different road surfaces, the cruising speed of highway, the deep grind of slow climbs. Life on the road. Where, according to fake Everett's incessant grumblings, he was permitted to drive 11 out of 14 hours before taking a mandated 10-hour rest. Then, regardless of actual time on the clock, say 11 p.m. or 2 a.m. or 4 a.m., he'd start driving again. And true to his word, away from loading docks, rest stops, and the hustle and bustle of civilization, he'd pull over and let me out. I got to pee, squatted behind bushes versus trapped in my own filth. I got to eat egg McMuffins for breakfast, Subway sandwiches for lunch, and fried chicken for dinner.
Downside of the job, Everett would say, handing over yet another bag of fast food, while self-consciously patting the grotesque swell of his belly.
Dinner was inevitably followed by other demands. He'd driven all day. Course he needed to blow off some steam. And he had his love nest all ready to go. Was it better being out of the basement? Was it worth it being out on the road? Where, from time to time, the blindfold came off, and I watched the world whiz by in a blur of greens and blues and grays. So many other vehicles racing side by side, so many other drivers, an entire country filled with assholes, as Everett liked to say. And yet not a single one who ever saw me. Everett talked a lot, complained mostly, and sometimes, once in a while, he even cried in his sleep. Which is how I finally learned about Lindy.
Chapter 20.
Dee Dee liked to be prepared. Hence, before she and Keynes met up with victim specialist Pam Mason at the FBI's Boston field office, Dee Dee did the practical thing and Googled her. According to the woman's professional bio, Pam Mason had a master's in forensic psych from John Jay. She'd worked crisis management at a major women's shelter in Detroit, talk about baptism by fire, Dee Dee thought, before joining the FBI. She'd moved around the Bureau for the past 15 years, including a stint in Miami specializing on human trafficking, then a position with the squad specializing in crimes against Americans overseas. The victim specialist was known for her work on a major kidnapping case in Mexico, where the oil executive was returned alive, and for a situation in Guatemala, where three young American missionaries weren't. In other words, the woman's work history was as impressive as the number of frequent flyer miles she'd accumulated. Dee Dee wondered what she thought of life in Boston, let alone her current assignment with the Summers family. Keynes had arranged for them to meet in his office at the FBI's downtown Boston headquarters. The meeting place didn't surprise Dee Dee. Federal agents were big on home court advantage. Though why anyone would consider the enormous concrete structure, one of Boston's ugliest buildings, in Dee Dee's humble opinion, an advantage, Dee Dee would never know. Then again, compared to the Hoover Building in D.C., never let it be said the federal government was known for good taste. Dee Dee debated bringing Phil along. Sure, he had his own work to do, with his own squad and his own co-detective, Carol, but the FBI valued appearances. Given she was meeting with two federal employees, it felt logical, even balanced, for there to be two representatives from the BPD. But the moment she thought it, Dee Dee knew she wouldn't do it, precisely because it smacked of politics, and she hated that crap. She'd called Keynes from Florence Dane's apartment not because he was a big-time federal guy, but because he was a known associate of the victim. She planned on keeping that tack here. Flora's disappearance was a BPD case all the way, hence Dee Dee's involvement as a supervisory officer. Interviewing Dr. Keynes and victim specialist Pam Mason was her call, and she would handle it. She was pleasantly surprised to find Keynes waiting for her in the lobby of FBI headquarters. Given it was a Sunday and federal agents prided themselves on working banker's hours versus an urban detective's relentless 24/7 drill, the building was quiet. Dee Dee still had to present her credentials and sign her life away, but sadly, no registering of the sidearm she was no longer qualified to carry. Once she'd secured her visitor's pass, Keynes escorted her to the elevators and away they went. He wasn't one for small talk. No, how was the parking? Did you find the offices okay? What do you think of the weather? Chatter. Instead, Keane stood quietly, hands clasped before him as the floors flew by. He'd discarded his heavy black coat, first time Dee Dee had seen him without it. For his Sunday attire, Keane's had gone with an impeccably tailored charcoal gray suit with just a hint of texture to the fabric. Dee Dee wondered if he had a whole closet full of suits, each one looking more elegant than the last. And just how much time and money did he spend on wardrobe anyway? She had on her caramel-colored leather jacket. It was her favorite. She wore it right up to the coldest, darkest days of winter. Now she noticed how shiny and worn the leather appeared at the cuffs. Oh yeah, and the apple juice stain lower right side. Awesome. Elevator stopped. Doors opened. Keynes gestured for her to step out first, so she did the honors. According to Dee Dee's research, the FBI had more than 120 victim specialists and four managers. Dr. Keynes, as one of the head muckety-mucks, was entitled to his own office, complete with an imposing cherry-wood desk, a long bank of bookshelves, and a smaller seating area to one side. His desk bore a state-of-the-art-looking computer, a leather cup of requisite pencils and pens, and of all things, a Rubik's Cube, colors mixed. Dee Dee couldn't help herself. Her gaze went immediately to the 80s phenomenon, and she was already itching to solve it. "You can, you know," Keane said, following her gaze. She kept her hands fisted at her side. "Who messed it up?"
"I did."
"To solve later? Or as a test for this little meeting?"
"Sergeant, you read entirely too much into a common toy."
She eyed him warily. "You're a behavioral expert. Of course I'm suspicious." He smiled. It was a good look on him, easing the severity of his smoothly shaved scalp, high sculpted cheekbones. For a moment, he almost appeared human.
I like to shuffle the cube. It helps me think. Given what we discovered at Flora's apartment, I've had much to think about.
I like mobiles, Dee Dee found herself saying, studying intricate patterns where at first glance it appears as one graceful, multi-leveled whole, and yet is in fact many separate levels moving in precise rhythm. A rap on the door behind them. Dee Dee and Keynes turned to find a woman standing in the doorway. Pam Mason, Dee Dee assumed. At first glance, the woman was older than Dee Dee would have thought. Ash-blonde hair worn in a close mass of curls that was last popular right around the same time as the Rubik's Cube. Even though it was Sunday, she'd followed Keynes's professional wardrobe example, though with less elegant results, having selected a block-cut 1990s tan suit with padded shoulders and a cream-colored silk blouse that buttoned all the way to the throat and was finished with some kind of silk ruffle. The victim specialist appeared about Dee Dee's height, but, with the cut of her jacket, appeared significantly wider. She was also a woman on a mission. She entered the office, simultaneously tucking a file folder under one arm while sticking out her other hand.
Sergeant Detective Dee Dee Warren, Pam Mason, victim specialist. I understand you have some questions about the Summers family.
The woman grabbed Dee Dee's hand in a firm grip, shook it twice, turned to Keynes with another brisk handshake, then moved straight to the seating area, ready for business. Dee Dee had to admit, she didn't care for the woman's suit, but she had to like the woman's style. A considerate host, Keynes did the honors of offering up coffee. Both women immediately agreed, and he disappeared in search of every investigator's favorite beverage.
Dr. Keynes has apprised me of the situation, Pam stated briskly.
Okay. Dee Dee shrugged out of her leather jacket, her motions awkward given the stiffness in her left shoulder. She took a seat. I'm sure you can understand we're operating on the QT for the moment regarding Florence Dane's disappearance. Press gets hold of this.
You mean the same media that raked the BPD over the coals on the evening news?
Thank heaven it was a Saturday, Dee Dee commented, as the weekend news had notoriously lower viewer numbers than the weeknight editions. Pam Mason arched a brow, but kept the rest of her thoughts to herself. She folded her hands, placed them on the small table.
How can I help?
Keynes reappeared. He bore two mugs of steaming coffee for them, nothing for himself. Man was so superhuman he didn't even require caffeine. Figured.
I understand that Rosa Dane is acting as a mentor for the Summers family.
Pam Mason nodded.
I'm wondering...
Dee Dee had to collect her thoughts, not sure how much she wanted to say, not sure how much she had to say.
I'd like to understand more about the Stacy Summers case, from the family's perspective. The father, Colin, called me this morning. At the first mention of Flora's name, he already assumed she was involved in taking down Devin Goulding. Given we never released that detail to the press, he knows things.
Exactly. Combine that with the fact Flora has taken a personal interest in Stacy Summers' disappearance and now appears to have gone missing herself. Another arched brow. Then it was Pam's turn to collect her thoughts. She took a sip of coffee.
I'm assuming you're familiar with the details of Stacy's abduction, she said at last, given that the BPD is handling the case. I know we have the world's most watched kidnapping video, and yet no real leads.
Do you think she's alive? Pam asked abruptly, which was not the question Dee Dee had been expecting. She found herself staring at Keynes, of all people, who sat with his long, elegant fingers steepled in front of him.
What's that expression? Dee Dee replied finally. Hope for the best, but plan for the worst?
I hope Stacy is still alive, but given the statistics on missing persons cases... Pam nodded. No doubt she was as familiar with the primacy of the first 24 hours as the rest of them.
I guess the question is, Dee Dee found herself saying, does the family believe?
Or maybe, she thought about it, does Rosa Dane, as their mentor, believe?
The family wants to believe, Pam supplied. Most families do. But as the days stretch longer with no sign of their daughter, they are under a tremendous amount of stress, both feeling the pain of their daughter's disappearance and the agony of their own helplessness. How are they coping? Interestingly enough, it's the mother, Pauline, who is probably doing the best, though I'm sure Colin would disagree. By all accounts, the marriage is a solid one, traditional New England roles. He's a workaholic investment banker. She raised their daughter, tends the home, and is involved in the community, church, local high school, various charities, the like. Stacy is their only child. Pauline suffered several miscarriages before her birth, which makes Stacy a miracle child. Dee Dee winced. She couldn't imagine that kind of salt on the wound. To have already lost multiple babies, then, 19 years later, having the lone survivor, no doubt the apple of her parents' eyes. Stacy is described as kind, vibrant, happy, athletic, Dee Dee said. Mother or father? Definitely takes after the mom. They're very close, the kind of mother-daughter that are often mistaken for sisters. Pauline took the news of Stacy's disappearance very hard. I'd never describe her as weak, but she's one of those women who wears her heart on her sleeve, which makes her transparent in her pain. Support network? Dee Dee asked. Good. In addition to church ties, they have a close network of friends in the neighborhood, other families from Stacy's school, that sort of thing. In the beginning, they were deluged with food, offers of assistance, etc., etc. One of my first jobs, in fact, was turning everyone away, given Pauline's delicate mental state. Delicate mental state? The initial shock definitely overwhelmed Pauline. She fell apart. But to be fair, she then let her support network help put her back together. The tight network of ladies from church, fellow moms, her own sisters, they give her strength. Colin, on the other hand, concerns me more. He's the consummate alpha male. For most of his life, there's been no problem he couldn't solve. Now this. The very foundations of his world have been rocked. Pauline externalizes her pain, which allows others to help bear the load. Colin purely internalizes. He was quite angry when he spoke to me by phone. The victim specialist merely nodded. And Rosa Dane's role in all this? She's the equalizer between the two. She's empathetic enough and optimistic enough for Pauline, Rosa's daughter's safe recovery 1 year later being an example of success, but Rosa is also tactical, which is what Colin wants. She's well-versed on media appearances, as well as the need in this day and age to work social media. Bet the lead investigator loves that, Dee Dee muttered. Pam Mason shrugged. All detectives wanted to control their own investigations, and all families wanted to be involved. Was Stacy close to her family? Dee Dee asked. Very. Any reason to harbor any suspicions on the home front? No. I've spent 3 months with the Summerses. They really were the postcard for family closeness, and frankly, I don't say that lightly. In my line of work, I spend more time pulling skeletons out of closets than framing happy family photos. So Pauline is leaning on family and friends to get her through, while Colin nurses his rage and rides the local investigators. Is he back to work? Yes, limited hours, but I recommended his return. Staying home isn't good for him. Work is how he copes. Dee Dee couldn't argue with that, given her own predilections. Is the wife angry about that? No. Like a lot of stay-at-home wives, she's accustomed to the house being her domain. Her husband's sudden appearance 24/7 strained the patterns of their marriage more than it helped. Part of my job is to help a family understand that the more it deviates from its established rhythms during the time of crisis, the more everyone's stress escalates. Normalcy is also an excellent coping strategy. Does Rosa Dane agree with that? The victim advocate hesitated. Rosa is a rare mentor. She listens to Pauline. She talks to Colin. I've been impressed. Generally speaking, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children's Program... Pam Mason made a noise in her throat. I've never worked with a family mentor, Dee Dee confessed. The program has the best of intentions. Let parents who've already been through the worst offer support to families who've just entered the crisis. I'm sure the volunteer mentors receive some training for the role, but at the end of the day, they're laypeople, not experts. They've had one experience, whereas someone like me? Pam's gaze flickered to Keane's. Like us? There is no such thing as one response to a crisis. Our job is to appraise the family and identify the approach that is right for this one particular situation, whereas the volunteer mentors, inevitably they are operating from a place of their own trauma. Whatever advice they offer, suggestions they have, has more to do with who they are and what they went through than the family they are supposedly aiding. To me, they're more inclined to try and fix whatever they perceive as having gone wrong in their case than help the new family through their own experience. Now, Rosa, on the other hand, Pam frowned. She's the rare mentor who seems to be able to distinguish between her daughter's disappearance and what the Summerses are now going through. How often does she meet with them? In person? Not often. Rosa lives 3-4 hours north, and given in the first 4 weeks the media circus camped out on the Summerses' sidewalk, she speaks to them by phone. Mostly. How often is hard for me to say. The Summers' phone rings a lot. But you've seen her, obviously. Twice. First time, she spent the day with mostly Pauline, quietly holding her hand. Pam paused, regarded Dee Dee intently for a second. That's rare. You know, just being with someone. I'm the supposed expert, and I'm not even that good at it. You have a job to do, Dee Dee countered. That's different. The victim advocate shrugged. Second visit was at the 5-week mark. Pauline was coming out of the worst of her funk. Rosa had more of a strategy meeting with both Summerses. Questions they should ask, rights they have, resources that are available to them. In particular, Colin wanted to know media strategies, how to make a personal appeal for his daughter's safe return, that sort of thing. I've seen a couple of those on the news, Dee Dee agreed. Rosa's advice was solid enough. Most of it was things we'd already told them, but I can understand it sounding better coming from someone who's been there, done that. The biggest thing she repeated, which I appreciated, is that this is a marathon, not a sprint. If they really want to be there for their daughter, they need to come up with a way to stop living from minute to minute, waiting for the phone to ring, and settle in for the long haul. Come up with a system for family and friends to visit where it's helpful but not overwhelming. Return to work, the everyday patterns of life. Ignore the press, unless it's on their terms. And her advice on managing the case detectives? Dee Dee asked. Because there had to be advice on investigator relations. Any family had issues with investigator relations. The detectives are not their friends or allies. They work for the state. If the Summerses really want to know what's going on, they should hire their own private detective. Dee Dee's eyes widened. Did they? Colin talked about interviewing candidates. Lovely. More cooks in the kitchen. Bet the case agent will love that. Pam merely shrugged. Do I think a private eye is magically going to make a difference in finding Stacy? No. Do I think it helps Colin feel more in control of the situation and therefore ease some of his stress in the short term? Sure. Problem is, Rosa Dane had it right. This is a marathon, not a sprint, meaning eventually a PI's lack of progress will be just as hard to take. So when did they meet with Flora? Dee Dee gambled. Rosa's daughter? They haven't, to my knowledge. Did Rosa discuss her daughter's experience? Yes. So they're familiar with her case. Makes sense they might want to personally meet her, don't you think? The walking proof that a young girl can disappear from a bar and still one day be found safe? Maybe, but I've never seen Flora at the house. Dee Dee frowned. She was following the Summers case. Closely. She shot Keynes a look. He didn't deny it. Again, Pam shrugged. Could she have talked to them by phone? Dee Dee asked. Possible. They never mentioned it, but Colin, especially, isn't one to share. Why are you so sure she had contact with them? Colin, when he called this morning, he asked directly if Flora had been the one to kill Devin Goulding, which was a pretty big conversational leap. Furthermore, when I pressed him about Flora, he immediately became evasive. I would swear he must know her, if only from what he wasn't willing to say. I never saw her at the house, Pam considered out loud, and Pauline never mentioned anything to me, but it's possible Flora met with Colin at his office. Why meet with him and not Pauline? Talk to the father, but not the mother, Dee Dee asked.
I might know the answer to that.
Keane spoke up abruptly. He was relaxed back in his own chair, fingers now clasped on the table.
By all means, Dee Dee indicated.
He turned his gaze to his fellow victim advocate.
According to your assessment of the family dynamics, Pauline, the mother, functions as the heart of the family, the emotional epicenter.
True.
While the father, Colin, he's the brains and the brawn. He's focused on tactics, strategies, anything to ensure his daughter's safe return.
Alpha male, Pam agreed.
Flora isn't interested in emotions. She's not comfortable with them.
Tactics, on the other hand, getting things done?
At that moment, Dee Dee got it, knew exactly where Keynes was leading.
Colin Summers didn't hire a private investigator to find his daughter, she said.
Keynes shook his head.
No.
Chances are, he hired Flora instead.
Chapter 21.
Are you in pain right now? Do your joints ache? Your fingers burn? Does your skull throb? No? Then you're fine. Are you thirsty right now? Doubled over with hunger pangs? Licking at your own skin just to have something to taste? No? Then you're okay. Are you freezing right now? Or maybe overheated, with sweat streaming down your face, feeling either stifling hot or bone-cracking cold? Not yet? Then you've got nothing to complain about. Are you lonely right now? Terrified or frightened or overwhelmed by the dark? Are you thinking that if he left right now, never came back, there would be nothing you could do? You would be stuck here. You would die here, all alone, and your mother would never know, never even get to bury your body, just as he threatened, promised, time and time again. No? Then you're fine. Listen to me. Believe me. Trust in me. I know what I'm talking about. I'm comfortable. I'm not in pain, or hungry, or cold, or hot, or frightened. I need nothing. I want nothing. I am fine. Locked alone in the dark? I'm perfectly all right.
When I wake up again, I'm immediately aware of a change to the room. Food. The smell of roasted chicken wafts toward me through the dense black, and the scent of something hot and savory. Gravy? Dressing? Mashed potatoes? Maybe all three? My stomach growls immediately, and despite my best intentions, I start to salivate. I still can't see. I remain alone in a sea of night, not even a sliver of light to illuminate the frame of a doorway, but the smell is strong and fresh. Definitely, there's food somewhere in the room. I sit up gingerly, feeling around with my fingertips. The last thing I want to do is knock over a plate of sustenance and waste this unexpected offering. I still have no sense of time or rhythm in this sensory deprivation chamber. Does a chicken platter mean it's dinner time? Of the day I was taken, or later? And does this mean I'm entitled to food? Three hots in a cot, as the saying goes? Or is this yet one more experiment being conducted by evil kidnapper? First, to explore my reaction to a cheap pine coffin, now to witness the animal in the zoo at feeding time. Had he read my case file? Maybe he's one of the crime junkies who followed my case in the news. A fan of sorts who heard about a girl who was kidnapped and held in a pine box, except instead of being horrified that such a thing could happen, it struck a nerve, unlocked a deep, dark fantasy he never even knew he had. Such guys exist. After I returned home, I received letters from several of them, turned on by all the lurid details of my captivity. I even received a marriage proposal. Because Jacob Ness isn't the only monster out there. And yes, they take an interest in one another's work. I remind myself I'm not interested in motives yet, just tangibles, and the scent of chicken could promise more than just food. What about a ceramic plate? Or better yet, a cutting knife?
I move slowly off the mattress, dropping to my knees as my tethering chain rattles behind me. It irks me to crawl on the floor. I'm nearly positive he must watch through the one-way glass, wearing night vision goggles to penetrate the gloom. Because, again, why go to all this trouble if not to enjoy the spectacle? Most likely he waited till I dozed off, then opened the door I haven't found yet, delivered the food, then exited in time to take in the show. I hate the idea of some person, some faceless, nameless freak, watching me crawl. But tripping over the dinner offering would be worse, so forward I go, bound hands in front of me, chain rattling behind me as I inchworm forth. The smell is coming from the opposite side of the room, where the pine box was. I make my way carefully through the dark, feeling my way with my fluttering fingers. Sure enough, I hit the edge of the pine box with my left shoulder. I pause, back up, feel around the edges. He's rebuilt it. Son of a bitch, I'd smashed the thing apart, left it in half a dozen distinct pieces. Why not? But now it's once again intact. I curse. I'm tempted to halt my pursuit of roasted chicken in order to destroy the box out of pure spite, but I force myself to stop and think. Why rebuild the box? Head games? Because even now, somewhere outside the viewing window, he's grinning to himself, watching me explore a cheap pine coffin with my fingertips. He wants a response, is probably leaning forward in anticipation of my look of terror. Fuck him. No way I'm giving him that satisfaction. Okay, so when did he rebuild the box? Surely if he'd come into the room, even while I was sleeping and worked on it, I would have heard him. And given I'd yanked apart all the various wooden panels, he must have removed it. Snatched up the pieces and carted them out. Then, after rebuilding it, or buying a second one, re-delivered it. This makes me frown. I keep my back to the one-way mirror, feeling suddenly uneasy. I'm not sure which thought disturbs me more. That my captor can enter and exit the room multiple times without rousing me, or that he might have an unlimited supply of cheap pine coffins. I finger the lacy edge of my satin nightgown. Again, the level of preparedness indicated by his actions. A predator who is more than your average bear. A man who's done his homework. He knows me. I'm almost certain of it. One of the men who wrote me a letter in the past 5 years? One of the very many predators who read every salacious detail of my captivity and thought, wow, if only I could get a girl like that for myself. My hands are shaking. With my wrists bound, I can feel my fingers tremble against one another, and I hate the weakness. Worse, my instinctive desire to start picking at my own thumb. Find a ragged edge, tear off the nail, use the pain to ground me, as I did so many minutes, hours, days ago when I was trapped in the box. Food. I can smell it so close it tantalizes. I need to focus. I'm hungry, definitely, and given I don't know when I might be able to eat again. Evil kidnapper might have read all about me. Evil kidnapper might even feel he knows me. But that was the old Flora. Not the one who spent the past 5 years studying, training, preparing. I am now Flora 2.0. I am a woman with promises left to keep. Dinner. The promise of sustenance. I will not waste it just because of a stupid pine box, some twisted blast from the past, or the unnerving realization someone is most likely watching me. Time to eat. I scoot around the box, inching forward with my bound wrists rocking against the floor. I explore between the box and the wall for the prospect of roasted chicken, but nothing. I move all around the box, continue through the rest of the room, nothing. Finally, I sit back on my heels next to the bare mattress, my back once again to the watcher's window, and contemplate things. Smell is hard to trace. It could be coming from another room, I suppose. Or worse, he's piping it in somehow. Maybe from the grate next to the one-way glass. Meaning there's no food at all. This whole thing is just like some bad science experiment where I'm playing the role of mouse in the maze. But the smell is so strong, so close. Heat. It comes to me. I'm not just smelling chicken, but I swear I can feel it. Steam wafting through the air. and I felt it strongest, smelled it sharpest, over by the pine box. My shoulders come down. Immediately I know what he's done. Son of a bitch. I cross back to the rebuilt second box. Sure enough, crude holes are drilled in the lid. Should I rub my fingertips against the jagged edges, tear my own flesh, jam a sliver into the softness of my skin, then suck out the blood? Good times from the good old days. Is that what he wants from me? I keep my fingers fisted tight as I lean closer and sniff at the first hole. Chicken. No doubt about it. And yes, I don't just smell it, I can feel it. A trace of heat and steam wafting up from the inside of the box. Son of a bitch. I find the padlock easily enough. Of course it's locked, because why not? As long as you're torturing someone with the olfactory promise of dinner, of course you're going to lock the actual food away. I mean, leaving the lid open? Where would be the fun in that? Am I hungry right now? Yes. Am I thirsty right now? Yes. But am I in pain? Am I terrified, depressed, beaten, too hot, too cold, too overwhelmed? No. Then I'm all right. I can think this through. Option one, walk away. Or, being me, more likely turn around, once more flip him the finger, then resume my position on the mattress. Disadvantages include going hungry, but also, food might not just be food. What about utensils, plates, hell, a plastic cup, resources, potential tools? The box is a care package of sorts, and being all alone in the dark, I can't afford to give up on the contents. Which means I'm going to have to open the box. I did it once before by hammering it apart with my bound wrists. I was pretty pissed off at the time and, frankly, trying to shake up the occupant, an approach I'm not so sure will yield great results for my prospective dinner. I could pick the lock. Mattress has coils. Coils mean metal springs. It would take some effort, but I have no doubt of my ability to make it happen. At which point, he would also have no doubt of my abilities. Do I want that? To give away so much so soon? To someone whose motives I don't yet understand and who apparently can enter and exit this room without waking me? My right thumb, slowly but surely seeking out my left thumbnail. Who is this guy? What the hell does he want from me? Why this terrible, awful satin nightie? And the box, the box, the box. I hang my head. For one moment, I'm not all right. I hate it here, I hate this man, and I hate myself because I did this to myself. 5 years ago, I escaped, and yet I've never gotten away. Jacob might as well be standing in the dark, laughing his fool head off. My own brother running away from the person I'd become, and my mom. My poor, resigned mother who gave up so much only to one day realize the daughter she loved so much will never come home again. She just gets the shell. The smell is starting to fade. The chicken, once piping hot, now starting to cool, and that, as much as anything, gets me moving again. Do you know who I am? I'm a girl who once loved to frolic with wild foxes. I'm the girl who survived 472 days in and out of a cheap pine coffin. I'm the girl who's going to get out of this alive. I fist my fingers, I raise my bound hands, and I swing them like a boom against the side panel of the box. It shudders beneath the force of my blow, so I do it again and again, bashing against the sides, turning my own body into a sledgehammer and wielding it forcefully. My knuckles bruise, my skin splits, as rough edges of the box catch and abrade, it doesn't stop me. Long ago I learned to separate my mind from my body, my emotions from my pain, and these lessons serve me well. As I batter the box into submission. When the side finally caves in, there's a cracking noise. I like it. I can't see what I'm doing, so it's nice to hear a satisfying wooden groan. Now I slow, picking my way through shards of wood till I can wrap my fingers around the edge of the collapsed lid and jerk it up and over. The metal padlock rattles, still intact, but now completely useless, given the entire other half of the lid has been wrenched from the body of the coffin. Good luck rebuilding this one, I think. And despite myself, I'm curious what its fate will be. But first, to the victor goes the spoils. It takes a minute, then I find it. Styrofoam plate, my first disappointment. Plastic bottle, however, so maybe water. No utensils. I search and search and search, nada. but the plate. In the dark, I poke the contents with my finger. Roasted half-chicken, cubes of potatoes, and what feels like some sort of rubbery vegetable. Finger food. Don't mind if I do. I turn toward the one-way mirror. I stare right at it, do my best to peer through it as I pick up the roasted leg and go to work. My fingers are greasy. The chain rattles down from the metal bracelets circling my wrists, rubs against my bare thigh. My satin nightie has ridden up, but I make no move to adjust it.